Hi, I'm Jeff Davis. It's time now to head out on the wine road. Recently, the University of California at Davis acquired the personal writings, papers, photographs, even tasting notes of wine writer Jancis Robinson. They'll be housed at the Shields Library, where interestingly, and yet not coincidentally, her longtime friend and wine writer Hugh Johnson's work is also housed. She co-authored The World Atlas of Wine with Hugh. She was the editor of the Oxford Companion to Wine. She's the wine correspondent for the Financial Times, holds the Masters of Wine credential, and even advises the wine cellar for Queen Elizabeth II. There's much more I could say, but let's get to it. The first thing I asked her was how she jumped from a mathematics and philosophy degree at St. Anne's College and Oxford into an assistant editor position at the trade magazine Wine and Spirit.
I took a salary drop. That helped. I had been working for 3 years in the travel business, then realized I didn't want to work in a great big company. Dropped out for a year to Provence, where I was surrounded by vineyards and people who really valued eating and drinking, and was determined when I got back to London to find a job in either food or wine, and applied for this one. And I think they were impressed that I'd taken a salary drop and that I'd organized the skiing side of Britain's largest travel company, and thought, here's a good organizer. She'll organize herself to learn all the many things she doesn't know.
And I'm sure seeing the vineyards and writing so much about the wine industry helped you really get enamored with the industry. And it didn't take too much longer. 9 years later, you earned the Master of Wine.
Well, I'd fell in love with wine when I was at Oxford, actually, with just being exposed to really good wine, and in particular, one great Burgundy that just lit the flame the way that many of us who end our lives...
Is that what we call the epiphany wine?
Yeah, that was the epiphany wine. So I was already mad about wine, and it was just a question of ignoring my contemporaries' a view of food and drink at that stage, amazingly enough, back in the 70s, that they were irredeemably frivolous subjects that an Oxford education would be wasted on. But by the time I'd got into the Wine and Spirit Education Trust treadmill, it really wasn't a very big step, in a sense, to having a go at the Master of Wine exam, because one follows fairly naturally onto the other if you're a masochist, basically.
I read that as a successful wine writer and critic, that led you to become the wine consultant for British Airways Concorde and their cellar luxury selection. That must have been a very fun and honorable position.
It was fun, and it was particularly fun to travel in Concorde a couple of times, which was it. And I was around Heathrow when the last flight came in to land, and it was very, very emotional, actually. I think a lot of people had a lot invested in that plane. But the wines we chose for Concorde, and it was great fun, actually, at that stage, being one of several British Airways wine consultants, because others were my friend Hugh Johnson, there was Michael Broadbent of Christie's, and we all just had a great time together. But after 9/11, they cut it back to just one wine consultant, which was me, which was sort of slightly less fun and more like hard work. No, but the Concorde cellar was so good that you would actually choose to get on that plane and drink those wines, which you can't say about many flights today.
Right. I guess if you had the pocketbook that allowed you to do that, you knew it was going to be a wonderful flight and some wonderful wine along the way.
Well, you'd be very disappointed if it wasn't, wouldn't you?
Aside from editing the World Oxford Companion to Wine and also working with Hugh Johnson and the World Atlas of Wine, you are well aware that Hugh donated his works here to UC Davis just a year ago. Now, did he help you get in here this year?
Very much so. It was Hugh who hosted Mackenzie Smith, librarian here, who and then said to me, she wants to meet you. And it was all Davis's idea to acquire my papers from 41 years of work. And it was great timing because we happened to be moving house after 33 years. Ah. So they'd accumulated, and I honestly hadn't worked out what to do with them. So I'm absolutely delighted that they may be some use to people here.
Yeah, there's some moving expense you didn't have to worry about. Huh?
Exactly. Saved me 13 FedEx boxes.
If you had a choice of any place in the world, would there be somewhere else, or would you pick UC Davis Shields Library?
Well, obviously, it would make sense for them to end up somewhere where English is spoken. So that narrows the field anyway. It would be, you might say, oh, well, Oxford's where you're educated and is the name of probably the book you're arguably best known for. But Oxford has no wine faculty. It has no particular reason for a collection of notes about wine. With there already being several collections here, including Hughes, it did seem to make a great deal of sense. And, crucially, they wanted them.
You're here tonight to talk about your thoughts on the evolution of wine in your 40, 41 years that you've been in the business. And I wanted to ask you what you think is the most significant occurrence.
I suppose I'm just aware of seeing big shifts in both consumer and producer taste over those years. For instance, when I started out, white wine was the thing, far more sought after than red wine. And Chardonnay was the height of fashion, and the world was short of Chardonnay. Can you imagine that? And then, of course, the pendulum swung towards red wines and towards a tiny handful of so-called international grape varieties. And now it's swinging very firmly away from them towards the sort of wild and woolly, more obscure varieties, varieties that perhaps withstand higher temperatures a bit better. And, of course, along with a trend such as identifying heritage tomato varieties and old apple trees and things goes a desire to look into indigenous grape varieties and recuperate them, which is fun, I think.
Sure. Do you see the much publicized millennial generation's interest in the wine industry and also the consumer's interest in exploring other wine regions as kind of adding to a new renaissance for the wine industry?
Yes, but I think the biggest impact is actually that of social media and all the ways that people communicate now, which has definitely eroded the arguably exaggerated power that a handful of us wine writers had at one time when consumers couldn't communicate particularly easily between each other. It wasn't me, mate. No.
Oh, I just you and yes. You and the media.
Yes, and I think that's very healthy, actually. I mean, I've had a subscription website since 2000, which seems to go from strength to strength, and I've always loved the fact that I learn from my readers and vice versa, and I'm much more open to criticism now than I ever was, and that must be good for me, really. And it's actually just fun, you know. We're all in it together now, rather than there just being a handful of sources of expertise who kind of handed it down loftily from a top of a mountain. You know?
Right. Yeah, it's nice to read a variety of people's opinions on certain,
whether they're consumers or professionals. Yeah.
Do you see a trend that is potentially harming the industry going on now that you're not terribly fond of?
I think things are more or less going in the right direction. I'm very glad that the wine market is very fragmented. So unlike, say, beer, although even beer's changing, or spirits, you don't have these absolutely giant companies dominating everything. Certainly in Britain, I think less so here, we have multiple retailers, multiple distributors, and in Europe, just tens of thousands of producers, which makes the whole tapestry very rich, really.
Right. Yeah, some of my favorite wines come from the boutique wineries that don't have the production distribution that the larger companies have, but sometimes you can find some magnificent wine.
And people can communicate about them. They don't, you'll see all sorts of people, I don't know, tweeting about something that's made a few hundred cases is worth, you know. It's a much more open, democratic world of wine today, I think.
You kind of touched upon it earlier, but do you see global warming being an issue?
Well, wine is absolutely in the forefront of showing the symptoms of global warming, more perhaps than almost any other product, actually, because it's made each year very obviously. And gosh, I see huge changes all over the world, both good and bad. It's fun that you can now make decent wine much nearer the poles than you ever could. And good old England is making some really quite creditable sparkling wine, for instance. And there are wine industries in Holland and Belgium and Canada. Denmark, and Canada's quality has gone zooming up. But in regions, say, like Châteauneuf, bits of Australia, they're really under the cosh in terms of heat and drought. Well, I don't have to tell you about drought until very recently.
Right. Thank goodness. I imagine this might be an ever-changing answer. Without the thought of food, climate, or time of day, what is your favorite go-to wine or varietal?
Oh, it's the huge variety of wine that turns me on, and there's never any one thing. I just love the fact that it's absolute miracle that the fermented juice of a single fruit can produce so many different tastes and styles. Mm-hmm. Love it. And the world, I'm still exploring the world of wine. Just made my first trip to vineyards in Patagonia and Baja, actually. And there's still lots of places I haven't been.
Have you been to Uruguay yet? They're making some fabulous wine down there, and what a beautiful country.
Yes, I have. I was there with the family, I think actually way back in 2002. Haven't been since, but my colleague, Julia Harding, who is a major contributor to the Oxford Companion to Wine with me, she's off to Argentina and Uruguay as soon as I get back home.
One more question. I have the book, American Wine, that you wrote with Linda Murphy.
Yeah.
And what did you find interesting about working on that book outside of California?
Well, I think the most interesting is the funny little places, really. Everybody knows about California and even Oregon and Washington. But, you know, who would have thought that there would be such good fizz coming out of New Mexico, for instance? You know, the Gruet lot. And I've always been very interested in the wines of New York State, for instance, and the mystery that for so many years Manhattanites never ever drank them. But I think even in Manhattan they're getting a bit of traction now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Finger Lakes are doing really well.
Yeah, yeah. And Michigan's got its renaissance wine industry, lots of sort of interesting new varieties and things. No, it's really interesting.
Thank you so much for your time. I know you have many people to talk to tonight, and I don't want to keep you any longer, but again, thanks so much.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
What a gracious woman. I could have talked with her for hours, but I knew a crowd was gathering to hear her speak, and just about that time, another wine icon, Warren Winiarski, who put Stag's Leap Wine District on the map, and Napa Valley for that matter, was entering the room. Warren was pivotal in obtaining the works of Jancis Robinson, as he donated the funds to do so. The Jancis Robinson papers on wine writing and criticism are cataloged and ready for public use at the Shields Library at UC Davis. You can learn more about her at jancisrobinson.com. If you're listening to this on iTunes or another podcast provider, you can learn more about my show at onthewineroad.com and on Facebook as well. I'm on Instagram under the name JD Wineroad and on Twitter at JD Wineroad. I'm Jeff Davis. Thanks for listening to this podcast of On the Wine Road.